Hey. That's a little loud. Let's go ahead and get started. I'm sure you can all hear me because that sounds like it's very loud. Well, welcome. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team at Microsoft. I'm super excited to be here again at Tech at Russia. This is my second time presenting at this event, and it's always great to come and see people I know and meet new people and also hear about all the people who are joining us online as well. So over the next 2 days, I'm going to be presenting four sessions on Exchange 2013. This is the first of four. This is the architecture deep dive. This is actually a two-part session. Part two is later on this afternoon over in room C2. Hopefully you'll join me for that as well, because if you don't, you'll only get half the story. So in this session, which is part of a larger track that we have on Exchange, Office, and Office 365, this session is going to focus mainly on three things. We're going to talk about the evolution of the server roles. We're going to talk about the architectural changes that we made. And we're going to talk about the client access server role. The next session after this, which is part two, we'll get more into the mailbox server role and some service availability changes. All right, well, let's get started. Let's think about the evolution of Exchange. How many of you have been running Exchange for a long time? Excellent. How many of you are running Exchange 2010? 2007? And any 2003? All right. Great crowd. Well, so then I don't have to tell you that back in the 2000 and 2003 days, that we had a fairly monolithic model where the administrator took the DVD, or in that case, the CD that had the bits on it, installed it onto the server, and every single thing got installed. Then after that, it was up to the administrator to configure the server the way they saw fit. Turn it into a front-end server, make it a back-end server, make it a bridgehead server, and so forth. It was also at that time that we completely relied on third-party technology for all of our data redundancy. We didn't have continuous replication. We didn't have any form of data replication. We were using either hardware vendors, storage vendors, or data replication technology vendors to provide us with high availability and site resilience at that time. Then we introduced 2007. And in 2007, we did a couple important things. The first thing that we did is we broke out the server roles. We created individual autonomous logical elements, the client access server role, the hub transport server role, mailbox, edge, unified messaging. So we broke out the functionality of Exchange into multiple servers. And that provided us with a great management model. It provided us with greater scalability because we were limited with CPUs. It may be taken for granted today, but back in the day when 2007 was designed, which was in early 2005, there were no multi-core processors. So this was another driving reason to split out the server roles into logical units. And we also began our long journey over successive releases to enable you to deploy cheaper and less expensive storage for Exchange as well. Then along came 2010. In 2010, in that era, we do have multi-core processors, so some customers are now benefiting from multi-role deployments, but still there are some customers who still deploy dedicated server roles. How many of you are deploying dedicated server roles with Exchange 2010? Okay, so all of you who have your hand up, if you are deploying dedicated server roles with Exchange 2010, stop doing that. Okay, our feeling is that multi-role is a better way to go. It's going to be more scalable for you. It's going to be more economical for you. It's going to be easier to manage. It's going to be significantly fewer servers in some cases. So we wanted you to go single roles with Exchange 2007. Again, we didn't have multi-core processors. With Exchange 2010, we do. And so that means you can benefit from having all the roles on one box and save yourself some money there and some management costs. And more importantly, put yourself in a deployment model that uses bricks, single multi-role servers that all have the same hardware profile that are basically disposable, if you will. Something happens to them, you can very quickly replace them with other parts or replacement servers. They're commodity hardware. So where are we going next with Exchange 2013? How many of you have had a chance to look at 2013? Okay, great. So in the previous server role architecture, again, we had these five roles. And our original vision for them was to be loosely coupled. In other words, that there were no interdependencies across these roles. Those of you who've deployed Exchange 2007 and 2010 know, in fact, that the opposite ended up being the case. They're very tightly coupled. They're tightly coupled in terms of functionality, for example. You can't deploy a mailbox role in an Active Directory site without also deploying CAS and Hub. They're also tied to a geo affinity, tightly coupled from that perspective as well. You have to have a namespace in every Active Directory site in which you're deploying Exchange. Otherwise, things get very complicated if you try to do a global worldwide namespace. You can see what we had in the previous version were these five roles, CAS, Mailbox Hub, Unified Messaging, and Edge out in the perimeter network. A lot of that has changed now. We had to address some of the challenges with those existing models, and let's be real about what they are. I mean, those of you who've deployed Exchange know that Exchange deployments can be complicated. They can be very difficult. The more users, the more business requirements that you layer on top of the design, the more complicated and difficult Exchange deployments can become. We also know that load balancing can be expensive and difficult as well. I mean, every new version of Exchange seems to bring with it some new requirements. Exchange 2000 brought Active Directory, for example. 2007, it was certificates. 2010, it was load balancing that was the hard part. We also know that when you're deploying dedicated server roles, all of you who raised your hand before said that you were doing that, you are leaving hardware resources in some cases underutilized and in other cases completely unutilized. So you're leaving money on the table when you do that. And lastly, there are a lot of challenges around namespaces as well. If you want a site resilience configuration for Exchange and you deploy Exchange into multiple data centers, you need a minimum of 9 namespaces just to support that. 6 or 7, depending on your configuration, of those need to go on the certificates as well. So that can be very challenging and complicated. So we made a lot of architectural changes in part to address these challenges and also in part to address other areas of Exchange that we thought could benefit both the service and the on-premise deployments. And we had one theme, and that was to use these building blocks, to use this principle of having a very simple scalability solution from the very smallest of on-premises deployments all the way to the largest Exchange deployment in the world, Office 365. That was our goal. And we had some characteristics of that goal as well. We wanted to evolve the server roles. We needed to evolve them to realign the way different components talk to each other across those server roles. We also wanted to be a friendlier citizen on the network and not require expensive and difficult load balancing propositions. And we wanted to support this interoperability and versioning principles. And by that I mean not just with previous versions, but also set the stage for interoperability with future versions of Exchange as well. So, what are the benefits that you get for the new architecture? You'll get greater hardware efficiency. Using the model that we have in Exchange 2013, you will spend less on hardware to deploy the solution than you would with 2010, 2007, and certainly 2003. You'll also get deployment simplicity as well. You'll see that we're just down to a couple server roles, making it a lot easier to deploy Exchange. You'll see that we've got cross-version interop and how we've done that between servers that exist today with 2013 and future servers that you can deploy tomorrow that have newer code on it. And we'll talk about how we've achieved failure isolation, not just with the client access server role, but also things that we've done in the mailbox role, largely, which will come in part 2 of this session. So what does the architecture look like? I mentioned it's a building block-based architecture. We have 2 building blocks. We have the client access server role, and we have the mailbox server role. When you group client access servers together, you can create a client access array. When you group mailbox servers together, you can create a database availability group. The server roles that you've known as the Hub Transport server role, the Unified Messaging server role, and indeed the old server in Exchange 2010 known as the Client Access server role, those don't exist as separate server roles anymore. The client access server role that I'll describe for Exchange 2013 is very different from the client access server role that we had in Exchange 2010. Okay, so let's talk about how we've achieved this failure isolation and versioning interop. We had one principal tenet while we were designing and developing Exchange 2013. And that tenet is this principle that every server is an island. So if you think about servers, consider server one, VN. This would be Exchange 2013, RTM. Over here, we have server two. This is VN plus one. It's the next version up. So this could be some later version of Exchange that, of course, doesn't exist yet because it's still in development. But we took this tenet of every server is an island, we put that into Exchange 13 to set the stage for that future version of Exchange that doesn't exist yet. So when you think about how you can break down Exchange functionality, it typically breaks down into these three groups. You've got your protocols and your server agents. They're responsible for things like authentication, client access, data rendering, and so forth. You have the business logic, the Exchange system objects, the APIs that we have, the middle tier logic that interfaces with the storage layer, which includes the store, ESE, file system, content indexing. Now, in Exchange 2010, we allowed cross-conversations, cross-communication between these layers. So, for instance, the transport component on one server could interface directly with the store component on another server. And it was this that was responsible for tightly coupling these server roles together. It was this that defeated our goal of having these server roles be loosely coupled. So what we've done in Exchange 2013 is we've changed the way that we allow these components to communicate with each other. We no longer allow communications through different layers on different servers. So, for instance, the Exchange Web Services, the EWS protocol, can only talk to the EWS protocol on other servers. It cannot talk to the store process. It can't talk to Exchange System Objects. It cannot talk to any other layer than where the EWS protocol exists. So the communication that we used to have in Exchange 2010 is banned. It's blocked. We completely prevent that. And in following through with this tenet and making every server an island like this, what that means is we are setting the stage for versioning and interoperability for the future. What that means is we no longer have a need to teach earlier versions of Exchange too much about later versions of Exchange in order to get them work. Now, we'll talk about this tomorrow in the deployment and coexistence session, which I hope you'll come to, but a perfect example of that is where we are today, where we've released Exchange 2013, but we're still waiting for updates for 2007 and 2010 so that those earlier versions can interop with Exchange 2013. For 2013, we've done that work ahead of time. We've made every server an island so that if we need a web service command from a version that's newer, we don't have to worry that this is an older version because ultimately that command is going to get sent over to the newer version, which will understand the new functionality, and that's where the command is getting executed. So it's a big, big difference from where we are today. Now, if you look at this from a functional perspective, it's, of course, much easier to understand. You can see the functional layering. We've got some form of load balancer up there. And then in Exchange 2010, we had, again, those three server roles that were providing the client access and the authentication and the other functionality. And then, of course, Mailbox had the server assistance, the store, and the content indexing components. Well, we've carved out the functionality. And a couple of things that we've done is, first, we've reduced the requirements for load balancing, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but the load balancing requirements you have are much less stricter than what we required in Exchange 2010, which means you can buy a less expensive load balancer and one that's much easier to configure as well. And basically what we've done with client access in 2013 is we've taken the authentication and the proxying and redirect components, and we've moved those into the client access server for 2013. Then the rest of the components, the protocols, the assistants, the APIs, the store, the content indexing, that all got moved into what's known as the mailbox server role in Exchange 2013. And again, part two of this session later on this afternoon, we'll cover the mailbox server role. So this is what things look like now from a functional perspective. It's much cleaner, much neater, much easier to understand, to deploy, and configure and troubleshoot. Okay, let's talk about the client access server role. So what is the client access server role in Exchange 2013? It does have some similar characteristics with Exchange 2010, namely, it is a domain-joined computer in the corporate Active Directory forest. It's not in a perimeter network, and it's responsible for things like client access, authentication, proxying, redirection, for all of the client access protocols, HTTP, POP, IMAP, and SMTP. It also has a UM call router component, which I'll describe in a moment as well. Now, think of it as a thin stateless protocol proxy. Now, we do call it stateless, but the fact is every Exchange server on the planet does have some state that's associated with it. So calling it stateless isn't 100% accurate, but from an Exchange perspective, it is stateless because there's no persistent Exchange storage on the client access server. Okay, so there's no mail.queue file, there's no mailboxes, there's no data stores whatsoever that's used by the client access server. So it's an Exchange-aware proxy server. It's a lightweight protocol proxy. It understands commands that it's getting from Exchange clients, from Outlook, from web browsers for OWA, from mobile devices and other components that support ActiveSync and so forth, or IMAP and POP clients. And it understands not just who's making those so that it can authenticate the user, but also where to send those requests to, which mailbox server hosts that user. Mailbox. Now, what's the client access array? This is, again, similar to what we had in Exchange 2010, but not exactly identical. In Exchange 2013, the client access array is simply a group of client access servers in the same Active Directory site. Now, in Exchange 2010, we called it something slightly different. We called it the RPC client access array. And that's because in Exchange 2010, it was for Outlook domain joined computers in the Active Directory corporate forest. Okay, so it was a cumulative, if you will, a load balanced RPC endpoint for those Outlook clients. Now, it's not used that way anymore. So we don't have an RPC client access array. We have simply a client access array, simply a group of CAS servers. Now, it does provide a unified namespace. So it is still providing one single place, one URL to give to your users, if you will. It also is providing the authentication layer through CAS. And of course, in front of it, you will still have a load balancer as well. Now, when you think about how we were using load balancers, think about the three things that we were using them for in Exchange 2010. Typically, there were three things. One was for the load balancing of the requests themselves to make sure that the requests weren't getting to overwhelm one server. Another one was for service availability to sort of send a ping to the virtual directories or to the hosts that it was load balancing in front of to make sure that they were responding, and if they weren't responding, they wouldn't direct client traffic over there. And the third thing we used it for was maintaining session affinity. And that was making sure that when I established a session for certain client access protocols, I was always going to be talking to the same server throughout the entire path of that communication. Now, in Exchange 2013, we only need two out of those three things. We no longer need session affinity maintained at the load balancer. We are now maintaining it at the mailbox server because we are sending all requests always and only to the mailbox server that hosts the active copy of the user's mailbox. So because all requests are always getting served by that one server where the mailbox is active, the session is always there. There's always a one-to-one proxy between the client and that server and that mailbox server. So we don't need to maintain session affinity at the load balancer layer anymore. And now we don't need a layer 7 load balancer that was doing that for us. As a result, we only need TCP affinity, and that's what a layer 4 load balancer can do for you. So much less expensive, much less complicated from a load balancing perspective for you. So what does it look like? Again, we've got a layer 4 load balancer up there. We've got up in that dark gray box is the CAS side, and down here is the mailbox side. So we've got our clients, our HTTP clients, Outlook Web App, Outlook, ActiveSync, the Exchange Administration Center, which is the new management, web-based management console that we have, and of course, Remote PowerShell. These are all HTTP, HTTPS-based clients. They will all send their requests through the load balancer. They will all get authenticated by the IIS component running on the client access server, and then they will be proxied to the mailbox server that hosts the active copy of that user's mailbox. Same with POP and IMAP. POP and IMAP clients will go through the load balancer. They'll get authenticated by CAS. CAS will then proxy them to the mailbox server that hosts their client. Same with SMTP. There's an SMTP component there, but it's an SMTP proxy component. It's not a full SMTP server. So when an SMTP communication comes in, the client access server will do some filtering, and I'll describe that when we get to the transport portion. But it will do some filtering, and then assuming it accepts the connection, it will proxy that to the transport component on the mailbox server. Now, UM is the only protocol that's slightly different. When we get a UM caller coming in, that's going to be through SIP. SIP and RTP, the protocols used by UM callers, really cannot be proxied due to the real-time nature requirements of those protocols. And so what will happen is, there will be a SIP request coming in, and then the UM call router will redirect that to the appropriate UM service on the mailbox server that it thinks is it's best. And then the UM caller, as you can see, will talk directly to that UM component after it gets that redirect. Okay, so let's talk about some connectivity changes. On this previous slide, I have Outlook up there as an HTTP client. Well, what does that mean? Well, we've changed the Outlook communication stack. We no longer support RPC over TCP connectivity to Exchange 2013. We support only RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere, for all Outlook clients connecting to Exchange 2013. So that's Outlook 2007, Outlook 2010, or Outlook 2013 have to be configured to use RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere. And this does a lot of things for us. First of all, it simplifies the protocol stack. It means that almost all client access into Exchange is now HTTP-based. And HTTP is a very reliable protocol that has the benefit of being designed for the internet, which is considered largely a low-bandwidth, highly latent network. Okay, RPC, on the other hand, especially RPC over TCP, was designed for LANs, well-connected networks, networks in which have high bandwidth and low latency. And so encapsulating the RPC packets into HTTP means that we can tolerate a bit more latencies and we get a simplified communication stack. And it also means we don't need the RPC client access array endpoint anymore. And because we don't need the client access array endpoint, we don't need the namespace that went with it as well. So right away, just by making this one simple change and requiring all Outlook clients to connect via Outlook Anywhere, we now have eliminated two of the namespaces out of those 9 that were needed in that multi-site environment. So right away, that's a big deal. And 2 that would need to be on the certificate. The other thing that's changed is when an administrator does a switchover or when a failover happens, or in certain scenarios when a move mailbox happens, the end user will no longer get a message that says the administrator's made a change that requires you to restart. That's another side benefit of getting rid of the RPC connectivity endpoint. So namespace simplification, that's another big thing. We now give you the ability to use a single global namespace. Now, there are other technologies that you'll need. It's not just going to be everything in the box with Exchange. But if you get those other technologies, that means you can deploy a single worldwide namespace, mail.contoso.com, for example, and have all your users, regardless of where they're located, always use that URL and will always get proxied or redirected to the appropriate location based on where their mailbox is. And it can be used in coexistence with Exchange 2010. In tomorrow's deployment and coexistence session, I'll show you the difference between an Exchange 2007 deployment and a 2010 deployment, and how just a single namespace can serve both a 2013 and a 2010 infrastructure. So what does that mean? Well, I'm going to show you an example that's combining several concepts. Of course, the primary concept is the use of a global namespace, mail.contoso.com. The secondary concept is this concept of geographic DNS, and that is nothing fancier than a DNS server that looks at the IP address of the client requesting resolution, and it hands out IP addresses based on the locality of that client. Okay, so for instance, if I'm in the U.S. and I resolve mail.contoso.com, I get IP addresses from the U.S. If I'm here in Russia and I resolve mail.contoso.com, I get IP addresses that are local to Russia. That's what we're talking about. So we have Sue. Sue is one of our employees. She is a mobile employee, so she travels frequently. And Sue is based in North America, so that's where her mailbox is located. She happens to be down here. Her mailbox is on one of these servers in this DAG. But she travels around, and no matter where Sue goes, all she needs to know is just go to mail.contoso.com, and that's how you check your email. So when Sue's traveling, she'll do a DNS query for mail.contoso.com, and she will get back perhaps multiple IP addresses. So when DNS is configured by the administrator, they will configure the DNS North American addresses for VIP1 and VIP2. And this other region over here in orange, let's just call that the Asia Pacific region. We've got two other addresses, VIP3 and VIP4, that the DNS server would hand out for requesters in that region. So Sue does a DNS request for mail.contoso.com, and she gets back the two addresses, one for VIP1, one for VIP2, and she'll actually round robin between the two of them. In one case, she might be connecting to VIP1, and that will proxy her to her mailbox, or in another case, she might be connecting to VIP2, and that will proxy her to her mailbox. So when she connects to one, she connected in this case to VIP1. VIP1, there's the CAS side, that proxies to the mailbox side, and Sue is in her mailbox. Now, VIP1 may go away, or Sue may simply re-request resolution by closing and reopening her client, and she might, through the next time, go through VIP2 and have the client access server behind VIP2 get proxied over to the mailbox server where her mailbox is. Now, let's say Sue is now in the APAC region. She's running and traveling around now. And again, she opens up her laptop, opens up maybe her browser or her Outlook client, and she resolves mail.contoso.com. Because she's in the APAC region, again, she's doing just the regular DNS query. There's nothing on the client side. But on the server side, the server's handing back two IP addresses, VIP3 and VIP4. And Sue, again, will round robin between the two. Maybe she'll go to VIP4 first, and that will proxy the communication over to her mailbox server. Or maybe she'll go to VIP3 first, and that will proxy the communication to her mailbox server. The idea is it doesn't really matter which virtual IP address she's talking to. And it doesn't matter where she is. She puts in mail.contoso.com. DNS has been configured for multiple IP addresses to be returned, and that's nothing fancier than multiple A records for mail.contoso.com. Now, if you want the GeoDNS feature, though, now Windows Server DNS does have this feature called net masking that can try to hand out addresses based on where the user is resolving them from. But it's not a true GeoDNS solution. If you want a true GeoDNS solution, you would have to use third-party DNS services that supported actual GeoDNS functionality to achieve this. Once you do that, though, again, it's nothing harder than going in and creating multiple A records that point to the same fully qualified domain name. They just have different IP addresses. And all modern HTTP clients, which is any browser that's newer than 10 years old, any operating system newer than 10 years old, and almost any modern mobile device supports this round robin of DNS on the client side. So let me illustrate some other client protocol flows. So here, the most simple one to imagine is the straight one where we've got the client who is connecting to CAS, and CAS is authenticating and sending them to the appropriate mailbox server. So you'll start to see a very straightforward pattern emerging here. So the client will communicate via HTTP. It will go through the layer 4 load balancer, and then it will talk to one of the CAS. The load balancer will send the traffic to one of the client access servers. The client access server will then first authenticate the user. Then after the user is authenticated, it will do two lookups. First, it will look in Active Directory to find out what mailbox version this user is running on. And we're looking to see if it's an Exchange 2010 or 2013 mailbox. If it is, then we do a second lookup for Active Manager to see if this mailbox is in a DAG and where it's located. After we do the Active Manager lookup, we know at that point where the mailbox is located, and so the client access server, after doing those lookups, will simply proxy the traffic to that mailbox server, and that is what's known as a local proxy request. Very, very simple. Now, let's say we have another Active Directory site. So now we've got two Active Directory sites. The client comes in, again via HTTP. It will go through the load balancer, get passed off to a CAS server. The CAS server will authenticate and look up the mailbox. And in this case, it found out two things. It found out first that the mailbox was located in another Active Directory site. And second, that this site up here has its own external URL defined. So instead of proxying the request, it will redirect it. So the CAS server is giving the redirection to the client. The client then connects to the other namespace, gets through the layer 4 load balancing, connects to CAS, which authenticates, and then communicates via HTTP to their mailbox database. Now, let's say we had another site, but this site is not internet-facing, and it doesn't include a client access server. It only includes a mailbox server. So again, the client communication comes in, the layer 4 load balancer hands it off to a client access server. The client access server determines that the mailbox is over here and that there is no external URL populated, so it cannot redirect the request. And so it will proxy that request and do a cross-site proxy to that mailbox server to retrieve that data. Now, a couple things I want to point out about this particular scenario. This scenario that I'm showing you now, this third site that just has mailbox only without CAS, is largely for illustration purposes only. Now, I described the server roles before as being loosely coupled in Exchange 2013, and that is the case. The mailbox server technically does not require a client access server in that site. But the reality is, from a practical standpoint, there's really no reason, as long as you're deploying the mailbox role, that you wouldn't also put the CAS role on there as well. So because there's no practical reason, when you read the TechNet documentation that talks about the requirements for mailbox servers, we are still listing that deploying CAS and mailbox together in every site is a requirement. Now, it's not a technical requirement, it's a practical requirement. There's nothing in setup that's going to stop you. This scenario will work just fine without a CAS. It will proxy just fine. But I wanted to point that out because you'll read the documentation that says CAS is required, and you might start to think, well, wait, which is right? They're both right. Technically, we don't require it. Practically, we do. We think there's no valid scenario where you would only deploy the mailbox role as long as you're deploying one Exchange server there. It doesn't make any sense. You've deployed mailbox, you might as well put the CAS bits on the box as well. They're not going to cause any harm. It's just going to be an endpoint to proxy through. Okay. Now, let's talk about this in a slightly different context, because I know a lot of you are upgrading from previous versions. So let's talk briefly about what the scenario would be in an Exchange 2010 coexistence. And then tomorrow's session, we'll talk about 2007 coexistence as well. So again, the client traffic is going to come in. As with all previous deployments of Exchange, it's always the newer version that answers the requests. So it's going to go through the layer 4 load balancer. The load balancer will hand it off to a CAS. CAS will do the lookup, and it will find out that it's actually located on an Exchange 2010 mailbox database and not a 2013 database. So in this case, CAS will proxy the communication over the 2010 CAS, and then CAS will talk via RPC to the 2010 mailbox server like it does today. Now, let's just say we're in a different site now. So we go through HTTP, we connect to the CAS server. The CAS server does the lookup over here, finds that the mailbox is over there, and the 2013 CAS server will proxy that over to the 2010 CAS, and then the 2010 will talk RPC. Okay, again, very, very simple, straightforward communication path. Now, let's say, though, that this was an internet-facing site, so we've got a load balancer up there. So now things are slightly different. Instead of proxying, we can redirect. So the communication will come in, CAS will do the lookup, find out that the mailbox is there, find out that there's an external URL value populated, and redirect over to the layer 7 load balancer, which will drop down to CAS and talk RPC to the store. Okay, so those are largely the communication scenarios that you'll encounter when you're in a coexistence period with Exchange 2010 and 2013. Again, we'll talk more in depth about that tomorrow, and we'll get into 2007 as well. I'm not going to go through this whole chart, but I did want to include it just for your own reference. This is basically showing the difference between a 2007 and 2013 coexistence versus 2010 and 2013 coexistence, and the namespaces that are required and the protocol behavior based on what you're doing. And you can see basically the Exchange 2007 accessing a 2010, that was kind of rough and confusing. The Exchange 2007 accessing Exchange 2013 is a little bit improved, but you can see the Exchange 2010 accessing Exchange 2013 has the best experience because it's very straightforward. It's largely going to be a proxy in most cases, except for when we have the ability to redirect. Okay, third-party MAPI products. For those of you using third-party MAPI products, there is a MAPI CDO download available for Exchange 2013. This is, however, the last version of Exchange for which we will be supporting the MAPI CDO download. Future versions of Exchange for integrated add-ons, you should be using Exchange Web Services. We've been saying this for a few years now. We've been telling people EWS is the way to go. It's our long-term investment for our APIs. We've been saying that at least since the 2007 days, and we strongly encourage everybody to move there quickly because this will be the last version of Exchange that will support the MAPI CDO download. And of course, the other thing to keep in mind is that if you do have applications that are MAPI based, they will have to be either reconfigured or you'll have to get new applications so that they can work with RPC over HTTP. If you're using a MAPI application that uses RPC over TCP, again, we block that so that application would not be able to connect anymore. So those applications, if you have them developed in-house, you may need to make some development modifications. If you bought them from a third party, you will want to contact the third party and make sure that their application works over Outlook Anywhere. Okay, Split DNS. How many of you are using Split DNS today? All right. So if you're not, it's something that we've been recommending for a while. And Split DNS is basically where you have the same fully qualified domain names in different DNS servers, one that's internal and one that's external. The internal DNS servers hand out internal IP addresses. The external ones hand out public internet IP addresses. This way, the whole point of Split DNS is to minimize the number of host names that you're using, to minimize the number of names you have to give your users. So this way your user only needs one name, mail.contoso.com. They don't have to use corp.mail.contoso.com when they're inside and internet.mail.contoso.com when they're outside, for example. Just give them the one name and use Split DNS. Split DNS is becoming a stronger recommendation in Exchange 2013 because it's largely going to be the only way to control internal Outlook client communication flow. If you don't use Split DNS, there is the potential for an internal Outlook client to query DNS and get an external IP address and send its traffic outside your network and then back in through your reverse proxy in order to communicate with an internal server. You don't want that to happen. You don't want internal traffic going outside and coming back in like that. Split DNS is pretty much the only way to control that from happening. So if you aren't using it today, we would very strongly encourage you to look at using split DNS to figure out how it can benefit your environment. Okay, let's talk about the front-end transport service next. So the front-end transport service is basically the SMTP proxy component that's also on the client access server. So it is responsible for handling all inbound mail coming into Exchange 2013. You also have the optional ability to configure it to handle all outbound mail leaving the environment as well. But it's not a true hop in terms of SMTP. It's not a store and forward. It's an SMTP proxy. Now, it does have access to the entire SMTP session, and it has that access so that it can do things like connection filtering and recipient filtering and sender filtering, but it's not accepting the message. All it's allowing is the communication to go through and passed on via proxy to the transport component that exists on the mailbox server. So it's really a lightweight SMTP protocol proxy that does have the ability to make very rudimentary decisions as to whether or not it should accept the SMTP communication. So it listens on the same ports that you'd be used to, TCP for server communication, 587 for client communication, and of course you can create other connectors that listen on alternate ports as well for additional communication pathways. If you do configure Exchange to send your external messages to go out through a CAS server, then we will stamp in the header and it will look like all messages leaving your organization are coming from that CAS server. If you don't do that, they'll look like they're coming from this transport stack on the server that's doing the actual sending. Somewhat similar to an internet-facing hub transport server, if you will. So if you look at what the transport service looks like on the client access service, it's very clean and neat and not complicated at all, again, because it's not a store and forward SMTP. It's an SMTP proxy. So there's no queue here. There's largely just the two components, the SMTP receive and the SMTP send component. And then inside the SMTP receive component are two pieces of functionality. One are the protocol agents that can do basic filtering, and the other is what we call the hub selector that determines where to route the message, where to proxy the communication to. So when messages come in from an external SMTP point, they go into the SMTP receive component. The SMTP receive component runs some protocol agents on it. It can do connection filtering based on sender IP. It can do recipient filtering based on recipient address and sender filtering based on sender address as well. Assuming filtering passes, then the protocol agents will hand it to the hub selector, and the hub selector will choose then the appropriate mailbox server to proxy that communication to. At that point, it'll be an SMTP from that send component to the mailbox server. So we are only talking SMTP through the entire conversation. Similarly, for messages coming from SMTP, they'll go into the SMTP receive component. We don't need a hub selector at this point because it's outgoing messages. So they'll go through the protocol agents. The protocol agents will then pass them off to SMTP send, and SMTP send will send them to the external SMTP host at that point. Very clean and neat type of process. So it's important to note, because it's so clean and neat, all of the transport activity that you're used to with Exchange, you recognize now, is not happening on CAS. It's happening on the mailbox server, and we'll talk about that in part two of the session. So that means things like categorization, bifurcation, that's not happening on CAS. CAS is simply there to determine whether or not it should accept the SMTP communication, and if it decides to accept it, where to proxy that communication to. The endpoint that it proxies to, again, is going to be some mailbox server. How do we choose what mailbox server? Well, it depends on the recipient. Just as we've done in the past, we do delivery based on what we call delivery groups. Now, we didn't call them that in previous versions of Exchange, but we are calling that them that in Exchange 2013 because that's largely how we're using them. So we decided to surface that into the product. So to figure out how to deploy, or excuse me, how to deliver to a delivery group, it's all based on the recipients of the message. So for example, if there's just a single mailbox recipient, we look to see where their mailbox is located and we send it to the transport server on the server that hosts their mailbox. If there's more than one recipients, then we will look for the mailbox server that's closest to us, favoring in the local site for proximity. Then if there are no mailbox-enabled users, for instance, if it's a distribution group or a mail-enabled user but not a mailbox-enabled user, then it's just a random selection of the mailbox server, again, giving preference to the local Active Directory site for delivery purposes. So inbound and outbound mail, it's very, very simple to understand. The front-end transport accepts the message for inbound mail, does rudimentary filtering, decides whether or not to accept it, and if it does accept it, passes it off to the appropriate mailbox server in an SFTP proxy. For outbound mail, the mailbox server does a lookup to see if you've configured all messages to go out through CAS. If you have not done that, mailbox will do a DNS lookup and deliver the message based on the MX records that way. If you have configured all messages to go out through CAS, the mailbox server will then send the message to a CAS server, and CAS will be responsible for delivering that, again, either based on smart host or DNS MX record lookup. So the benefits of the front-end transport service that you get this lightweight, very scalable type of service that allows you to do basic filtering before the majority of the message comes into the organization. The content filtering is done on the mailbox side, but the other filtering connection, SMTP sender and receiver, those are all done on the CAS side. You also get the network protection because it's centralized, it's load balanced, it's, as I said, highly scalable, and it has the mailbox locator, so it's always trying to determine the best place to send the message to. Okay, no more using AD sites, no more trying to get it as close as possible. We're trying to find exactly where to send it to by looking at the mailbox locator. So the benefits that you get, just talked about those. I think that's two slides formatted differently. So the benefits of the CAS architecture, it very much simplifies the client layer for you because it makes all clients HTTP-based, Outlook, EAS, EAC, PowerShell, and so forth. It also means that you've eliminated the RPC client access array and the namespaces that goes with it. It also means that we have simplified namespaces for you as well, not just in eliminating them, but also giving you the ability to have a single global worldwide namespace. And we've got the deployment flexibility, again, giving you the option to deploy just those two server roles in basically any manner that you see fit. You can do multi-role in Exchange 2013. You can do dedicated roles in Exchange 2013. Our preference is still going to be multi-role, but we give you that deployment flexibility just like we did in previous versions as well. All right, and with that, we should have a few 10 minutes for questions. Please don't forget to check out the other sessions in this track as well. It's not just about Exchange. It's also about Office 365 as well. And, of course, here's some great resources for you, both the Exchange 2013 documentation, the Exchange 2013 SDK, the software development kit as well, the Exchange team blog, and, of course, check out my blog as well. Please also don't forget to fill out your surveys. It's important that we get them for all these sessions. And here's my contact info. Feel free to contact me, but I've intentionally left time for questions at the end of this session, and we'll also have time for questions in between sessions as well. I'll be out at the Exchange booth on the floor as well. So, any questions? Hopefully in English. Yes. Sure. So the question is, when are we going to release the service packs and the required updates for coexistence for 2010? And I'm assuming you also like to know about 2007 as well. Okay. So we've actually put that on the Exchange Team blog. We've announced that they will be available the first quarter of next year. So that's sometime after the first of the year. We'll have them available. They are still under development. So that's Service Pack 3 for Exchange 2010. And the next roll-up update, which I expect to be update roll-up 9 for Exchange 2007 Service Pack 3 as well. Once those are released, then you can go ahead and actually do coexistence with Exchange 2013. Until those are released, you cannot do that. In fact, we've got hard blocks inside of setup that will specifically look for these coexistence updates on all of your existing legacy servers. And if those updates are not present, then setup will simply stop and not allow you to go forward. So unfortunately, you know, you will have to wait a little bit more before you can do coexistence. But typically though, if you look historically with how many IT shops operate around the world, this time of year, people are really getting close to IT freezes. They don't like to do changes right towards the end of the year sometimes. Especially something big like a messaging system upgrade. So it's actually to your benefit to wait just a little bit longer for those coexistence updates to do that. Certainly put Exchange 2013 in a lab today and get to know it because there's numerous differences, but it's okay to wait for a little bit longer for those updates. Yes?
Thank you. Are there any improvements of UM server role? That's all? Are there any feature improvements to add in the UM server role?
Are there feature improvements to the UM server role? Is that your question? There are several around the link integration. There's an improvements around the speech to text translation that we get in the messages. There's improvements around efficiency of the codecs used to compress the messages, both on the WMA and MP3 sides. There's auto attendant improvements. There are personal attendant improvements and manageability improvements through the Exchange Administration Center.
Thank you for your great session.
Thank you for attending.
Thank you. Now we got Exchange 2014, and my question about DLP system in that product. We have now many foreign templates, French, Spanish, where Russian templates. How can protect my Russian data?
Sure. So we do have a mechanism where you can request that stuff. If you want to send me that in email, send me that request in email. I can send that off to the folks who make it. There are also third parties that are making those templates as well, and we do support the import of those into Exchange. So if we can't make one for you, there may be local third-party folks who are making them that will import, and then our engine will recognize that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
Hello. Two questions. First, how you said CAS makes two lookup to mailbox when inbound traffic comes. I wanted to ask a little bit more about technology of these two lookups.
Sure.
And the second question, what about edge role in your Exchange? About edge role.
About the edge role. Ah, great. Okay, excellent question. So in terms of the lookups that it does, so when a request comes into CAS, CAS needs to know where to send it. So the first thing it does is it looks in Active Directory to find out the version of the mailbox. And from an Exchange 2013 perspective, we support three versions, 2007, 2010, and 2013. If the mailbox is located on a 2010 or 2013 mailbox, that means the true source of where it's active is going to be coming from Active Manager. If it's on a 2007 box, that means the true source of where the mailbox is will come from Active Directory. So the first lookup we do is to figure out what version it is. Is it 2007, 2010, or 2013? Right. If it's 2007, then we'll do another Active Directory lookup, and these are just LDAP queries to find out where what mailbox server hosts it. So that's 2007. If it's 2010 or 2013, then we actually do an RPC into any DAG member, and that DAG member has an Active Manager component. Any one of them can answer, and they'll do a lookup in their own database and tell us where that mailbox is located, and then that will be the server to which CAS will proxy the communication. So it's LDAP into Active Directory, RPC to Active Manager to any DAG member that is running. Oh, sorry, yes. Second question, the Edge Transport Server. So I actually did have that. Yes. Yes, I actually had it up here in the new architecture diagram. It's like way, way back at the beginning. Right here. Yes. So looking at the new architecture where you've got CAS and CAS array and mailbox and DAG, there's Edge, except that it's either an Exchange 2007 or an Exchange 2010 Edge Transport Server. Currently, there is no Exchange 2013 Edge Transport Server. That is something that we've said will be a post-RTM deliverable. So what does that mean? That means sometime after RTM, there will be an Exchange 2013 Edge Transport Server. Until then, you can use the 2010 or 2007 Edge Transport Server.
Hello?
Yes.
My question about this noisy pop-ups when you see the administrator made changes and mm-hmm. something like this. I think everyone maybe once see this notification. So you mentioned what this notification in 2000, in the next version of Exchange, there's no such notifications. So I would like to hear from you what exactly the mechanism of this. Because sometimes sure. when you use the site resiliency mechanism, so you have two data centers, and if database is moved from one to another, there's the option when Outlook changed the CAS server where he connects. So, and the user received the message what administrator made changes and he have to reboot his Outlook mm-hmm. also.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, sure. Great question. So the short answer is that it was all because we were based on RPC communication. And the way in which we were using, we were actually taking the RPC client access server array property that existed for that user and stamping it in their mailbox database. So when you would create a new mailbox database in an Active Directory site in Exchange 2010, there would be a property that would get stamped on it that would either point to a CAS server or the RPC CAS array. And it was because the mailbox was tied to the CAS array that anytime you move to a different site, which assumes a different array, you're going to have this pop-up that says, the administrator made a change, you're used to talking to this RPC array, but you can't anymore because your mailbox is over here. You need to restart Outlook and we'll stuff the new array property into your profile and make that update for you. So that's all gone in 2013. There's that's been abstracted for a few releases. So in 2010, it was abstracted by showing you the client access array that they were connected to. In 2013, the client access array doesn't exist anymore, and we simply use the user's mailbox GUID to populate that value instead. So when you try to look at the server that they're connected to, it's going to be GUID at whatever your domain is. And that's basically going to be a reference to the user's mailbox, and it's not going to help you figure out the server name at all. You're going to have to do your own separate lookups to find out where that user's mailbox is currently active. So that won't be surfaced through the Outlook client anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So it looks like the same auto discover experience that you get today, which is basically type in your email address and your password, and auto discover configures everything for you. If you want to go through the manual process of putting in a server name and manually configure the profile, just randomly pick any CAS server, or if you're outside the environment, use the IP address that you've configured externally, and Outlook will allow you to manually configure that as well. Right. Yeah, you'll still get server information. So for instance, if you go into the test email auto config and do that, you'll see all that server information. Or if it's an Outlook web app client and you go to the help about, it'll show you all the good server information. So even though you won't see it in the connection status and we don't show it in the profile, you'll see it several other places throughout the client. So no, the client connects to CAS, and as their mailbox moves around, they still connect to that same CAS. Yeah, if the CAS is not available, then hopefully you've got another CAS, and your load balancer will not send traffic to the one that's not available anymore, so traffic will go to CAS that are... Oh, if the site's down? Well, that depends on your namespace configuration then. If you're using a single global namespace, like the example I showed, in that case, the failover will happen at the client level, and I'll talk about that in the HA session tomorrow afternoon. Yeah, if that's what you're wondering from a site level event, yeah, that's all HA tomorrow, tomorrow afternoon. Yes.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for your presentation. And short question about all those changes with front-end transport server service. And haven't heard anything about shadow redundancy.
Yes.
Is it still in place?
It is. And actually, we'll talk about that in the part two of this session. Because all that shadow redundancy, a lot of the mechanisms are happening on the mailbox server now. Remember, the CAS is just a lightweight SMTP proxy. So we really haven't talked about what used to be hub transport and what's now transport on mailbox.
Okay, so one more question then for client access server.
Yes.
You said that there is no need for session affinity for load balancer. No.
Correct.
More. And so, but still I can see that there is authentication service on client access server.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Authentication part on client access server. Yes?
You're asking what is the authentication part?
I see that there is still authentication part.
So it's using Kerberos authentication.
Server, yes. Yeah. But so the question is that if there is no session affinity on load balancer and some of the cost server will go down and the session will go to another client access server, so how in this case...
The session's not on the client access server. The session's on the mailbox server. But the session is always and only on the server that hosts the active copy of the mailbox. The client access server is a stateless, thin protocol proxy, so there's no session on the CAS server. It's only on the mailbox server.
Does that mean that there is, so once a user was authenticated on the first client access server and was proxied to mailbox server, there is no need already to authenticate even if the client access server will go down?
No, there's not. They'll use cache credentials in that case. Yep. All right, let's just quickly check time. I think we're actually 3 minutes over. So I'm going to pack up now, but I'm just going to be right outside at the Exchange booth until part two of the session, which is at from 6 to 7 in room C1. So hope to see you there, and thanks for coming.